Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with children's books authors John Muth and Mo Willems.
City Dog spotted something he had never seen sitting on a rock. It was Country Frog. "What are you doing?" asked City Dog. "Waiting for a friend," replied Country Frog with a smile. "But you'll do."
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. New York Times food writer Christine Mulkey discusses Anthony Bourdain's new memoir.
He exposed a world that no one understood yet. He was really at the forefront of the whole kitchen obsession, the whole foodie obsession. I mean, he really blew the door open onto that world.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. We like nothing better on the podcast than to talk to children's books authors and illustrators. And two of the very best are with us today. And what's remarkable is they have collaborated for the first time. Mo Willems and John J. Muth have written City Dog, Country Frog. It's reviewed for us by Jim McMullen, who has so much praise about it that I won't embarrass them by reading it. And I'm also happy to say that Julie Just, our children's books editor, is here to lead the conversation. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Mo, you, I know, were a Brooklyn man, like many great children's books authors, and you have now left the city. Is that right? So
yes,
you're in
I
the
have.
Country.
I have. I was in New York for over 20 years, and about a year and a half ago or so, we moved to a little town in Massachusetts.
Is that partly what gave you the idea for City Dog, Country Frog?
Well, you know, actually, we had a little place in Connecticut, which was the gateway drug to leaving. And that is where I wrote the book. You know, we would go to this place every weekend. And every time we went, the entire environment was completely different in a way that I had not experienced living in the city for decades. And so I started to sort of look at how different it was, how I didn't have a country place, but I had 52 country places, and I didn't quite understand them all. And then I started writing a story through the eyes of my dog. My dog gets older. My dog is living in dog years, and it started to get me thinking about frog years and other animal years, and that's sort of how the book came about. And initially, my plan had been to draw it, because I've drawn every book that I've ever written. And I drew it in sort of my normal cartoony style, and the story was a little too serious for it. And I did watercolors, and that didn't work. I probably spent 3 years on this until my wife cut the Gordian knot for me. I turned to her one day and I said, you know, I really wish that I could draw like John Muth. And she said, John Muth can draw like John Muth, which was a revelation.
And John, talk about how you found out about the project or what your response was when you heard
right.
from Mo.
Right. Mo sent it to me, and when I got the chance to get around to reading it, which took me just about a week or something like that, I really liked how he gently bumped into the themes that were going on in the book. You know, it had his trademark succinct kind of almost haiku-like writing and a minimal kind of writing, and then but the themes were there. I mean, and it was engaging, you know, the idea of loss, and in a way that I thought was still comfortable, and I thought it worked.
In the book, you have these two friends meet, the frog and the dog, and they form this great partnership. And then by the end of the book, it's implied the frog has gone away. It's the winter is past. And there's a wonderful line, I think, where is it the chipmunk shows up and the dog says, I'm waiting for a friend, but you'll do. And that so speaks so much to the way kids are, that it's very tentative the way they make friendships, and sometimes very sudden, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Did you find it helpful? I mean, you have children now, so you probably have watched them go in and out of many environments.
Yeah. I mean, I think that to a certain degree, it is a rumination about friendships. And I see my daughter's friendships. I see my friendships. Now I'm old enough to have started to reconnect with people that I didn't think that I would reconnect over years and whatnot. And I find it to be a subject that still confuses me. And that's usually when I write a book. If I don't understand it, then I should write a book about it. If you understand something, then you write a manual. And I'm not a manual writer. I guess that is part of it. It's not only change, but the change in relationships and my trying to grapple with that comes out in this story.
I've got a question for John.
Yes.
Did Mo show you the illustrations?
He did not. He had taken some photographs of the place that he imagined this might take place. And he sent me the text along with photos of his the property you were talking about. And so I had an atmosphere to go with the story, at least what he was plotting. Then I had to kind of throw that out and do my own.
And the dog.
I know his dog purse. His dog calls me often, so yes. I know the dog.
Everyone in my family has to earn, and so it was the dog's time at this point to do some work.
And when you guys collaborated, the text was written.
Mm-hmm.
Then the pictures are drawn. Was there a moment when you were actually in the same room working together?
No. That's not really how it works, and that's sort of the great letting go of it. Once John agreed to do it, I knew I had a very specific ideas about the book. I knew that the left-hand page had to be text. I knew the right-hand page had to be image. I knew the book had to be square. And I had a lot of sort of technical and philosophical reasons for that. I had never written a book that I hadn't drawn. And so usually when I'm drawing, I take out words. I mean, the book is never done until the end. And suddenly I realized this manuscript is finished too soon. So I redrew the book, which allowed me to get rid of all the words. And then at that point, it was just pure trust. I had to let it go and wait for however long it took to start getting paintings back. I certainly makes me feel for people who, you know, in quotes, just write books as opposed to write and illustrate them, because it's terrifying.
Mo, you have an interesting background because you came from, do I remember, stand-up comedy and also Sesame Street. So were you doing artwork all along?
Yeah, I was an animator. I did a lot of performance, but I started out as an animator doing weird little independent films, and then backwards, I got hired to work for Sesame Street, which for me was great because it was a sketch comedy show, and I wanted to be a sketch comedy writer. And only about two or three seasons into it did I start to realize that I enjoyed writing for children and that I enjoyed it more than writing for adults. So I've always written and drawn sort of throughout my career, and I've never really considered myself a writer. This is kind of the first book that I ever wrote, and to the degree that there was a Word document that could be my finished product, as it were. It was weird.
Since we've teased our listeners and we've gotten our authors and guests more comfortable, now I'll quote from some of our review. Our reviewer, Jim McMullen, says the text is both efficient and beautiful, and the art beautifully illustrates the changing landscape and emotional high points of the story. And now, a special treat, both Mo and John will read from their new book, City Dog, Country Frog. Mo, you want to go first?
Happy to. Spring. City Dog didn't stop on that first day in the country. He ran as far and as fast as he could, and all without a leash. City Dog spotted something he had never seen sitting on a rock. It was Country Frog. "What are you doing?" asked City Dog. "Waiting for a friend," replied Country Frog with a smile. "But you'll do." City Dog and Country Frog played together. City Dog was new to the country, so Country Frog taught him Country Frog games. Country Frog's games involved jumping and splashing and croaking. That was spring.
Summer. City Dog didn't stop to admire the green, green grass. He ran straight for Country Frog's rock. "I'm going to do you a favor," said City Dog when he found Country Frog. "I am going to teach you City Dog games." City Dog's games involved sniffing and fetching and barking. City Dog and Country Frog played until Country Frog was too tired to sniff and fetch and bark anymore. That was summer.
That was Mo Willems as Spring and John Muth as Summer, reading from their book, City Dog, Country Frog. Thanks to both of you for coming in. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Thanks, it was great.
Yeah, thank you.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So J.K. Rowling is back in the news with these nagging plagiarism accusations. What's the latest?
So these accusations have been around for a while now. Last year, Bloomsbury, Ms. Rowling's British publisher, was the subject of a lawsuit by the estate of an author named Adrian Jacobs. And Mr. Jacobs is now dead. He died in 1997, but he wrote a book called The Adventures of Willy the Wizard. And his estate accused Ms. Rowling of stealing plot outlines and said that there were many similarities between the two books. So now Ms. Rowling's U.S. publisher, Scholastic, has been the subject of a lawsuit this week. It's the same kind of lawsuit, and Scholastic hasn't yet made a formal response, but it's unclear how they'll respond. They've been able to stay out of this whole plagiarism accusation until now.
Do they have any kind of case to make?
Well, it seems like the main gist of the argument was that there were plot similarities between the two books.
The similarity between the very first, the
this source. Is actually the fourth book.
Oh.
This is Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, which was published in 2000. Now, Jo Rowling says this is absurd, that she had never even heard of Adrian Jacobs' book until 2004, 4 years after her book came out. But what his estate said is that they shared an agent, Ms. Rowling and Mr. Jacobs. Now, the agent has spoken up this week and said that he was not Adrian Jacobs' agent. So that seemed to take some wind out of this plagiarism accusation.
And there have been other accusations like this, right? Is this something that almost any phenomenally successful author will be subject to?
Certainly someone who's as wealthy as J.K. Rowling. I mean, she's the first person in the United States to become a billionaire from selling books. So there's certainly a big pot of money that someone could possibly hope to get a little chunk of. But I think these things do tend to follow people around, and it's very easy to say that your book is like my book.
And how far has this case gotten? Will she actually have to prove she didn't plagiarize it, or won't it reach that stage?
It's not clear yet. Right now, Scholastic has said very little about the lawsuit. They may respond to it at some point this week. But it's not clear how much she will have to personally respond to it beyond what she's already said, which is that it's totally untrue.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
First up, a lightly cured hamachi with seaweed, rice pellets, and edamame pureed with horseradish. The hamachi is cured in salt, sugar, coriander, and Sichuan pepper for 2 hours, like a quick Western Chinese Scandinavian gravlax thing.
That's solid delicious.
Even if you're not a foodie, and I'm not, you know about Anthony Bourdain's memoir, Kitchen Confidential, which was a huge bestseller. He now has a new book. It's called Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. It's reviewed for us by the Times' great Christine Mulkey, who is the food editor of the New York Times Magazine, and she's here to talk about it. Hi, Christine.
Hi there.
So what's Bourdain up to in this new tell-all book?
Well, more of the same.
Is it raw?
It is indeed medium raw. You get a lot of raw, but you also get a lot of semi-cooked material.
What adventures does he describe in this new book?
Traveling the world, eating the best food with the most interesting people and chefs, and really talking about how he reacts to it and how he receives it. There's a lot of Tony in this book.
And he's a pretty acerbic guy. What does he have to say about, Rachel Ray or somebody?
Well, he and Rachel made amends. She was very smart. She sent him a fruit basket. And, you know, he is a nice guy. He realized you can't really be a jerk if something like that happens.
Well, what happened?
Not very printable or repeatable words that we can.
So is there a lot in this book that isn't printable or repeatable? Is he profane in this one?
It was hard to find clean quotes for you.
Really?
Yes.
And who is he? I mean, what's his background? Where's he from?
He's actually from Connecticut. He's from a good family. Went to Vassar briefly and then realized he had more fun cooking and hanging out doing drugs in Provincetown.
Well, who wouldn't? How good a cook is he?
No comment.
No comment. How good a critic is he?
He's really good. He has fantastic taste. He's quite honest in saying that he is just completely biased and you know, won over by all of these people. But he has a really wonderful palate. He has incredible enthusiasm and love for the business and love for the food world and the people who cook. And he makes it sound delicious.
And he's a good writer?
He's a really good writer. My problem with this book is that he also needs a really good editor. There's some really wonderful things here. Just needs to be tightened up a bit, lose a couple chapters, and I'd be very happy.
Okay, let's compare it to Kitchen Confidential. Is it fair to call that book a classic?
Yes.
And why?
Because he exposed a world that no one understood yet. He was really at the forefront of the whole kitchen obsession, the whole foodie obsession. I mean, he really blew the door open onto that world.
And it made him a celebrity,
yes,
like of the first order. You can't turn on the television without seeing and hearing this guy.
He's a star.
Does he have scores to settle?
Yes, yes, very much so. There's one chapter called Heroes and Villains, which is this sort of schoolyard, I like you, I don't like you, I like you, and here's why. And it's very juvenile, and it's also pretty funny, and I'm sure after this review comes out, I'm going to be on one of those lists.
Thanks a lot, Christine.
Thank you.
That's Christine Mulkey, the food editor of the Times Magazine, who reviews this week Medium Raw by Anthony Bourdain. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, our old friend James Patterson is back on top of the fiction list. He's at number one with his latest Private, co-authored with Maxine Pietro. Jenny Duvanovich falls down to number two with Sizzling 16, her latest Stephanie Plum mystery. I should say that this past weekend I read the first Stephanie Plum mystery, so now I'm in on what this is all about.
And?
You got to read it for yourself. Another interesting thing, David Mitchell, the much ballyhooed British novelist, scores his first American bestseller with The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. It enters at number 14. Of course, it went to number one in Britain when it was released back in May.
And we reviewed that on our cover, Dave Eggers.
Right? Dave Eggers loved it. Everybody loves it. So after I finish the next 15 Jenna Duvanovich novels, I'm going to move on to David Mitchell.
What about nonfiction?
Not a lot of news here. Justin Halpern is still on top with Stuff My Dad Says, followed by Anthony Bourdain, Medium Raw. Only one new book, Sean Payton, the New Orleans Saints coach, enters at number eight with Home Team, his book about their Super Bowl victory.
Now, what about Christopher Hitchens, who has been a guest on this podcast several times, has a new memoir, and now we know he's quite seriously ill. Is he still on the list?
He's still hanging on at number 15 with his memoir, Hitch 22. You know, interestingly, sort of in the wake of his announcement that he had esophageal cancer, a sort of debate broke out on the internet about whether it was okay to pray for him. You know, he's a famous atheist, had a big bestseller with God Is Not Great. And, you know, opinions seem sort of divided. His friend Johan Hari, the British columnist, said, you know, he wrote on Twitter, I forbid everyone from praying for him. He would hate that. Hitchens himself doesn't seem to have surfaced with any official directives, but some of his friends have consulted the relevant authorities and decided it's okay. Jeffrey Goldberg, his colleague at The Atlantic, emailed a rabbi in Los Angeles who has debated Hitchens a number of times about the existence of God, and this rabbi gave Goldberg the go-ahead to pray. He said, you know, it's just an expression of your deepest hopes and, you know, you aren't harming anyone by doing it, but you shouldn't expect someone like Hitchens to be grateful. I myself am taking my directives, though, from a commenter on the Times' Art Beats blog who reacted to the news of Hitchens' illness by saying, the small blue glowing matter in my brain is beaming quarks to your vital spirit.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.